Hello and welcome to Stick Together, Australia's only national radio show dedicated to workplace and social justice issues. Stick Together is produced in the studios at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network. My name's Annie McLaughlin. Today we look at long-term industrial disputes in the emergency services sector in Victoria as the state heads to a November election. Victorians have become used to seeing ambulance windows with messages such as "Dennis is a menace when it comes to emergency services," as a protest about the $25,000 wages disparity between Victorian paramedics and their compatriots in other states dragged on without resolution. We talked to Danny Hill from the Ambulance Employees Australia about the recent Victorian government's wages offer and the trade-off paramedics are supposed to make to access the wage increase.
Well, the latest offer that government put forward back in a few weeks ago was a $3,000 sign-on bonus, 6% upfront payment, followed by payments of 3% and 3%. We have some concerns with the dates of those, that the pay rises are coming in, but our main issue for our members now is not so much about the amount of money, but it's the trade-off, the conditions that they want paramedics to give up in order to get that pay rise. Now, we're talking about setting up new roster systems so that paramedics who work in rural Victoria, say in a centre like Ballarat, could be sent against their will, could be forced to go and work in remote locations. So you could be a paramedic who's a parent with a couple of kids, or you might have elderly parents or medical appointments in Ballarat, and then you get told, well, next month you're out to Edenhope for the month, and you have to go out there. And in some cases, they work a 24-hour on-call roster where they have to stay at the branch for 8 days straight. Now, there's no way that we can accept that for our members. The job's hard enough. It's fatiguing enough. These sorts of conditions are just completely draconian and will just make the job that much harder for them to do safely.
And so what are you saying, that they should actually be employing more paramedics?
Well, look, that's one part of it. Certainly there are more paramedics needed, but I think the major issue at the moment is not just about the amount of paramedics, but it's the type of work that paramedics are doing. It's their workload. You know what I mean? So they're being sent more and more to cases that they don't, that don't require an advanced life support or an intensive care ambulance to be going to. They're sending, paramedics out now to patients with stubbed toes. And if that patient with a stubbed toe has got, you know, a bit short of breath because they're hyperventilating, then it's upgraded to a light sirens case. So the system has become much more risk averse. The job is getting busier and busier and busier, and paramedics just aren't getting the downtime that they need. So there's a number of things that need to be fixed. Certainly more paramedics are needed, but the job has just got to be brought back from the brink as far as being such a stressful and fatiguing job that, you know, we could potentially lose a lot of paramedics who are just going to quit and burn out over the next few years.
I've just recently been looking into OH&S, and this is obviously an OH&S issue. But sure. And something that was coming through in the OH&S issue was the superimposing of risk management over OH&S, this need for the class that employs, the employer class, to feel that they're in total control without enough consultation with workers who actually do the work. Do you think that's fair, that this is, to say that there is an element of this in this kind of dispute?
Look, I couldn't agree more. I think some of these sort of roster systems and these practices of work and systems of work, they put all the control in the hands of the employer and take more and more discretion away from, you know, the worker who works on the front line. So for a paramedic, you know, they're no longer, if this deal was to get up, then, you know, a paramedic would no longer have the guarantee that they're going to be working in the town that they live in. They may live in Bairnsdale, yet they're going to be told, well, next month you might be out to Orbost or up to Omeo. How are you supposed to put your child through schooling or book in for swimming lessons or medical appointments? Like, you know, things that every other worker gets to do and every employer probably gets to do in their own time. You know, they're taking that sort of, you know, very basic of human rights away from workers and away from paramedics in order to replace it with these very, very strict work choices like laws that and rules that just means that paramedics can be forced against their will. You know, you will go to Omeo next month, and you know, if you disagree, well, that's just tough. That's part of the job.
So it's been 2 years that you guys have been working to try and get some resolution to these issues. And I might be sounding cynical when I say that the movement that you've finally had coming from government seems to be related to the November election that's coming.
Yeah, we are moving closer and closer to the November election. I think as we do that, government gets, you know, they've put themselves in this position where they're so far out, they're so close to an election, yet you know, you've got the most credible, one of the most credible workforces in dispute with you. I mean, surely they would see that that's not going to do them any favours leading into the election. I guess that's their choice. Our concern is that our members have gone, as you say, coming up to 2 years of negotiations, well over 2 years since our first log of claims was submitted to Ambulance Victoria. That was in April of 2012. I mean, so it has been a long, long time. Paramedics in Victoria have not had a wage rise since August of 2011. That's coming up to 3 years ago since there's been any increase in their wages. Meanwhile, fuel goes up, cost of living goes up, cost of groceries and bills and things like that go up, and paramedics are left languishing.
Is there an element of an issue of governance in relation to this? I mean, the sticking point now is a lack of awareness of ordinary people's existences and the social dislocation that would be caused by people having to move across the state like that at the whim, I guess, of whoever it is that's doing the rostering. Does that seem to imply that the government actually hasn't got its finger on the ordinary pulse of the ordinary person?
I'd have to agree with that. I don't think they do have their finger on the pulse of the ordinary person, but I question whether they even are interested in what the ordinary person thinks. I mean, you know, more and more I feel that, you know, the government just expect workers to, you know, emergency service workers to just be the buffer between, you know, between the system working well and the system falling apart. I think they just expect that paramedics will just, they can just continue to be flogged and continue to do another job and just one more job and just one more job. But, I mean, it has deadly consequences when you act like that. And we've seen multiple patients who have died or been severely injured and waited a long time, or severely unwell and waited a long time for an ambulance to get to them because those resources just haven't been there or haven't been available. So, yeah, look, I think government do play a dangerous game with this sort of attitude, but, you know, that's why paramedics, I think, are such a highly represented, highly unionised workforce, is because they know that they need to lobby government and convince them that, look, you have to take action here and you have to get involved and you have to fix the problems in the ambulance service.
Now, you're in Bensdale at the moment. Is there any reaction from the local members down there?
I'm actually in Sale now, so I had a meeting in Bensdale. I'm dashing about all over Gippsland meeting with members. And, look, the message from them is crystal clear. It's unanimous. Yes, they want a deal and they want it to happen soon, but they will just never agree to this reduction in working conditions that is being proposed right now. They're just never going to agree to that. And as far as I'm concerned, nor should they. But they tell us what they want and what they think. And the message from them is crystal clear. So we'll be continuing to, you know, to engage in this dispute as long as it takes to get a fair outcome for our members.
Stick together. You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
You are listening to Stick Together, the only national radio program devoted to industrial news and social justice issues. In this edition, we are following up disputes in the emergency services in Victoria as the state moves towards a November election. Over a 20-day hearing this July, the Fair Work Commission has been hearing the Metropolitan Fire Brigade, the MFB's, application to have the MFB-UFU Operational Staff Agreement 2010 terminated. This agreement is the agreement which, as a result of consultation between the MFB and the United Firefighters Union, sets out conditions of work for firefighters. The significance of this dispute cannot be overstated. It is a front line between neoliberal economics versus the unavoidable resources required to protect a community from the effects of fire. We spoke to Peter Marshall, Victorian Secretary of the UFU.
Well, what's at stake is clearly this. Public safety will be significantly compromised if the MFB achieve what they're trying to achieve in Fair Work Australia. Firefighters' conditions of employment and certainty of knowledge that their equipment they used will not fail at the time when they need it most. That process will be completely removed. Victorians who are covered by the Metropolitan Fire Brigade will be subject to fire cover based on performance-based contracts, whereas reduction of cost will result in a bonus to the bureaucrats running the MFB.
So this is all revolves around an agreement from 2010, the Operational Staff Agreement 2010, which was agreed to by the MFB and the CFA, but basically they're reneging on it, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. What they're doing is one of the most disgraceful acts of contempt towards the employees I've ever seen. For example, the minimum staffing is enshrined in the enterprise agreement, and that is that the people covered by the Metropolitan Fire Brigade will have 270 firefighters on duty at any one time, strategically relocated around Melbourne to ensure a timely response. The MFB want to reduce that mandatory requirement, and if they believe a fire won't happen on a certain day or night, they want to reduce the number of firefighters down to 246, the number of fire trucks from 60 down to 52. Now, I can tell you, these are people who are on performance-based contracts that get bonuses for saving money. And I cannot see anywhere in any fire service in Australia or globally where a fire chief will have a crystal ball who can predict when a fire will occur and, most importantly, at what time, what location. Apparently, the people running MFB who are behind this proposal seem to think they have that capability.
There's been a lot of concern about, or lack of confidence. Neil Comrie, who's the head of the MFB board, as well as some lack of confidence in the MFB executive leadership team under the stewardship of Peter Rao. Can you, he's the chief fire officer, can you speak to that?
Oh, yes, I can. There has been an extraordinary amount of discontent expressed in a professional way towards the MFB board and indeed towards the MFB executive leadership team in relation to the MFB's proposal to scrap or terminate all conditions of employment that currently are enshrined in those enterprise agreements rather than negotiate a new one. On top of that, the attack has been one of a significant volume in relation to litigation to remove firefighters' conditions. And may I say that that attack is being perpetrated by the MFB using fire service levy money that your listeners pay for the provision of fire cover. So the fire service levy money that people pay for fire protection is actually being used by the MFB board and MFB executive leadership team to actually reduce fire cover. Now, I'm sure if your members had a say in that, or your listeners had a say in that, they would not condone that behaviour. But getting back to Mr. Comrie, Mr. Comrie is an ex-police officer and no doubt held in high regard in certain circles. But I can tell you that within the fire services, there is a growing discontent of having no confidence as him being the head of the MFB board. Mr. Rao, who was the chief fire officer recently appointed, has only been in the MFB for a short period of time and probably has lost the respect of all firefighters that actually currently serve under him. These people ultimately will reap what they sow. And at the moment, there is a process of determining either confidence or no confidence in Mr. Comrie as the head of the board, Mr. Rao as the chief fire officer, head of the executive leadership team, And I can tell you, I think I know what the outcome is going
to
be.
I mean, is it true to say that during the entire coalition government period that there's been an attack on previously understood need to consult with firefighters over what are the requirements of the MFB and that this has been attacked during this period?
From the onset of the change of government, when we had the NAPFINE government actually take power, there has been an extremely adversarial, regressive and litigious approach to anything in the fire service to do with firefighters' conditions of employment, certainly acknowledging the safety of their equipment and anything enshrined in their enterprise agreements. In fact, if you have a look at the MFB and CFA's annual reports, the expenditure on legal fees is grown enormously as soon as, and you can see that growth occur as soon as there was a NAPFINE government elected. This is against the backdrop, whereas previously, Combrie signed off an agreement under a CEO who espoused the accolades of how wonderful the agreement was for the fire service and all the benefits to the community. What we are seeing here is a government that just simply does not care about emergency service workers, has no understanding or empathy as to how dangerous their job is quite happy to cozy up for a photo shoot at any given time, but when it comes to ensuring that they have the security and knowledge that their equipment, whether it be uniform or entry equipment or firefighting equipment, is of the best calibre and gone through the most rigorous testing process, NAPFINE and his government go missing.
I mean, we've had several extreme fire events in Victoria, I mean, extreme fire events, and there was, a commission into it, and it was decided that there should be 342 additional firefighters for the CFA. Now, actually, they're refusing to do that, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. This is a written agreement that was enshrined in a common law deed as well as an enterprise agreement. Mick Burke, being the Chief Executive Officer of the CFA, simply decided that the CFA were not going to honour that agreement. They have reneged on the delivery of the 342 firefighters in the most breathtaking and audacious way that firefighters just could not fathom. How you could actually sign up to agreements and then simply change your mind. But more importantly, what does that mean to your community that your listeners are... the community being simply this, but in those areas where it warranted a urgent increase of firefighting numbers because that community was unprotected, are going left unprotected. There's currently fire stations that close during various times, revert back to a volunteer response because there are simply not enough firefighters. If Victorians had a say and had full knowledge of what is happening to both the MFB under Mr. Combrie and under Mr. Burke, I think you'll find that the community would want a change of leadership in those organisations.
So does that mean that the ads that the NAPFINE government's been putting on the TV that says that the fire levy, all the money that is collected for the fire levy is going into fire services, is that not true?
Grossly misleading. I'm sure when they say all to the fire services, when you pay a fire levy, if you look at the government website, it talks about for the provision of rescue, fire suppression, et cetera, et cetera. It does not say for the provision of litigation against industrial instruments or taking away firefighters' conditions. It does not say that excessive use of credit cards, which we've seen evolve at the CFA headquarters, it doesn't say excessive increase in salaries of senior executives in the organisation. So the fire service levy money is not going to where it is needed. It may go to either into a line item in the government budgeting process saying fire service, but it is not going towards community protection, and that is ensuring that the 342 firefighters are employed, that areas of the community are actually have a fire response capability, and indeed the firefighters have the best possible equipment. that money is not going where I just described.
Stick together.
You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
You are listening to Stick Together, the program which looks at workplace and social justice issues. The East-West Link is an infrastructure project in Melbourne which has been billed as a project which will provide jobs for workers in the construction industry. Despite strong community objections against the tunnel and freeway which will cut through inner city communities and destroy public lands, there has been a conspicuous silence from the unions. This may be because the jobs envisaged from the project outweighs community consternation. At a recent public transport rally in Melbourne, a letter from Wes Hall, Assistant Secretary of the ETU, put another perspective.
We had planned to have Wes Hayes, the Assistant Secretary of the Electrical Trades Union, come here and speak today, but unfortunately he had a personal commitment that he couldn't get out of at the last minute, but he has sent in a very brief letter of support that I just want to quickly read out. And Wes says, the ETU's always been supportive of any employment opportunities that add real value to the society we live in. In saying this, as a union, we believe that the jobs are created, they should work in conjunction with the community and not against it. Long-term jobs in public transport outnumber jobs in toll roads by a ratio of at least 3-1. The amount of patronage in public transport compared to toll roads is behind comparison in favour of rail and tram links. Why would a government invest in a toll road without a business plan when the figures in favour of public transport investment are so clear? As a trade union, we support jobs that are sustainable to the environment, secure for our members and beneficial for the community. On this basis, the only answer that can be given for this project is that rail links are an investment for the future for all people and toll roads only benefit the big shareholders of those companies. Say no to tolls. Thank you, Wes Hayes, Assistant Secretary of the ETU.
Stick together.
You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
As a mark of the concern felt by the producers of the Stick Together show regarding the war going on in Gaza, before we leave you today, a word from that indefatigable British MP George Galloway at the pro-Palestinian rally in London.
Brothers, sisters, friends, I give you George Galloway!
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The entire world is today transfixed. Every newspaper in the entire world has on its front page, every news bulletin in the entire world has as its lead item the horrific massacre of 300 innocent civilians, so many of them children, so many of them women, killed without a reason by bloodless fanatics, careless of the destruction of human life that they have caused. Of course, I refer to the 300 innocents shot out of the sky in eastern Ukraine. The 300 Palestinians are completely ignored by the same newspapers, by the same television companies, and by the same political leaders who are now threatening sanctions and war against Russia, but who are supporting with weapons and money and diplomatic, political and media support the Israeli killers who killed the Palestinians. In fact, if whoever fired that missile in Ukraine had fired it instead at the beach in Gaza, the media could have knocked off for an early lunch and saved themselves all of this work and all of this coverage. I have only 1 minute to make 2 points. Why the double standard? Why is the blood in Ukraine so much more newsworthy, so much more noteworthy than the blood in Gaza? And my last point in the last 30 seconds is this. Forgive me if it's a discordant note. This massacre in Gaza is the reason for the coup in Egypt. It wasn't because Morsi was no good. It wasn't because of the fit or the cut of his suit or his language. They carried out the coup in Egypt to clear the decks for the massacre of the Palestinian people in Gaza. They want to end the Palestinian people, but the Palestinians will never surrender, and we are here to say, as long as one Palestinian remains alive,
inshallah,
we'll be with them. Free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Palestine!
Assalamu alaikum, thank you.
That's it for Stick Together this week. Thanks to you for listening in. Stick Together is produced at 3CR Studios in Melbourne and broadcast nationally on the Community Radio Network. The podcast is available at 3cr.org.au, and you can contact the producers of the show at stick.together@gmail.com or by going to our Facebook page. Thanks to Danny Hill, Peter Marshall, Wes Hall and George Galloway for their contributions. My name's Annie McLaughlin. Catch you next time.